The architects drafted a strong attack on the Project Mind's changes, ending the missive with a series of unambiguous demands. But the Mind had been alone. Save for its host of mechanical servitors, builders, masons, miners, sculptors, and assorted winged minions, for a long time now. It had watched the seasons change for a full year, had sifted the data of 400 sunrises and sunsets from every window in the house, had attended to the play of shadows across every square centimeter of furniture. And so, in the manner of smug subordinates everywhere, the Project Mind managed to misunderstand its master's complaints. They were so far away, and it was just an artificial. Perhaps its language interpreters were faulty, its grasp of human usage undeveloped due to its lonely existence. Perhaps it had sustained some damage in that long-ago fall from the sky. But for whatever reason, it simply could not comprehend what the architects wanted. The Project Mind went its own way, and its masters, who were busy with other projects, threw up their hands and forwarded the expanded plans, which changed daily now, to the owner. Finally, only a few months late, the house decided it was finished. It requested the third stage of its deployment. The final supply drone came across the harsh, cold southern skies. It landed in a cleverly hidden lifter port that raised up amid the ice sculptures, representing mastodons, minotaurs, horses, and other creatures of legend, in the western valley. The drone bore items from the owner's personal collection, unique and irreplaceable objects that nanotechnology could not reconstruct. A porcelain statuette from Earth, a small telescope that had been a childhood gift to the owner, a large freeze-dried crate of a very particular kind of coffee. These precious items were all unloaded, many-legged servitors straining under the weight of their crash-proof packing. The house was now perfect, complete. A set of clothing exactly matching that in the owner's capital apartments had been created, woven from organic fibers grown in the house's subterranean ecologies. These gardens ranged in scale from industrial tanks of soy analog lit by an artificial sun to neat rows of Belgian endive in a dank cellar and produced enough food for the owner and three guests at least. The house waited, repairing a frayed curtain here, a sun-faded carpet there, fighting a constant war with the aphids that had somehow stowed away with the shipment of seeds and earthworms. But the owner didn't come. He planned several trips, putting the house on alert status for this or that weekend, but pressing business always intervened. He was a senator of the Empire, and the first Rick's incursion, though of course it wasn't called that yet, was underway. The prosecution of the war made many demands on the old Solon. In one of its quiet moments, he came so close as a takeoff, his suborbital arcing its way toward the house, which was already brewing a pot of the precious coffee in breathless anticipation. But a rare storm system moved across the range. The senator's shuttle forbade an approach. In wartime, elected officials were not allowed to indulge risk levels above 0.01% and carried its grumpy passenger home. In fact, the senator was not much concerned with the house. He had one just outside the capital, another back on his home planet. He had seeded the house as an investment, and not a particularly successful one at that. The expected land rush to the southern pole had never materialized. So when the Rick's invasion ended, the owner placed himself in a long overdue cold sleep, never having made the trip. The house realized he might never come. It brooded for a decade or two, watching the slow wheel of the seasons and made a project of adjusting once again the play of light and shadow throughout its domain. And then the house decided that perhaps it was time for a modest expansion. The new owner was coming. The house still thought of her that way, though she had owned the house for several months and had visited dozens of times. That first absentee landlord still weighed on its mind like a stillborn child. The house kept his special coffee hidden in a subterranean storage room. But this new owner was real, breathing, and she was on her way again. Like her predecessor, she was a senator. A senator-elect, actually, not yet sworn into the office. She suffered from a medical condition that required her to seek periodic solitude. Apparently, the proximity of large groups of humans could be damaging to her psyche. The house, which over the years had expanded its sculpted domain to 20 kilometers in every direction, was the perfect retreat from the capital's crowds. The senator-elect was the perfect owner. She allowed the house considerable autonomy, encouraged its frequent redesigns and constant mountainscaping projects. She had even told it to ignore the niggling doubts that it had suffered since its AI rating had increased past the legal threshold, an unintended result of its last expansion. The new owner assured the house that her senatorial privilege extended to it, providing immunity from the petty regulations of the apparatus. That extra processing capacity might come in handy one day in the business of the Senate, she had said, making the house glow with pride. The house stretched out its mind again to check that all was in readiness. It ordered a swarm of reflective butterflies to focus more sunlight on the slopes above the great cliff face. The resulting melting of snow would better feed the waterfall network, now grown as complex as some vast pachinko machine. The house rotated the central skylight so that its faceted windows would in a few hours break the setting sun into bright orange shards covering the great room's floor. And in its magma-warmed lower depths, the house activated gardening servitors to begin preparations for a meal or two. The new owner was, for the first time ever, bringing a guest. The man was called Lieutenant Commander Laurent Zai. A hero, the house was told by the small portion of its expansive mind that kept up with the news feeds. The house jumped into its preparations with extraordinary vigor, wondering what sort of visit this was to be. Political? Of military import? Romantic? The house had never actually seen two people interact under its own roof. All it knew of human nature it had gleaned from dramas, news feeds, and novels, and from watching its senator-elect spend her lonely hours here. Much could be learned this weekend. The house decided to watch very carefully indeed. The suborbital shuttle was a brilliant thing. The arc of its atmospheric braking was aligned head-on with the house's sensors, so the craft appeared only as a descending, expanding line of heat and light, a punctuation mark in some ecstatic language of moving, blazing runes. The house received a few supplies, those exotics it could not produce itself, via suborbital, but those arrived in small, single-use couriers. This shuttle was a four-seater, larger and much more violent. The craft was preceded by a sonic boom, flaring hugely in the house's sensors, but then became elegant and avian, its compact maneuvering wings spreading to reduce the speed of its entry. It topped the northern mountains with a dying scream and swooped down to settle on the landing pad that had risen up from the gardens. The dusting of snow on the landing pad began to melt in the shuttle's heat, the pad becoming wet and reflective, as if mist were clearing from a mirror. Icicles hanging from the nearest trees began to drip. The mistress and her house guest had arrived. They waited a few moments inside the shuttle while the landing area cooled. Then two figures emerged to descend the short exit stairs, hurried by the not-quite-freezing summer air. Their breath escaped in tiny puffs, and in the house's vision, their self-heated clothing glimmered infrared. The house was impatient. It had timed its welcome carefully. Inside the main structure, a wood fire was reaching its climax stage. Coffee and cooking smells were peaking, and the last few servitors rearranged fresh-cut flowers, pushing stems a few centimeters one way and then the other as some infinitesimal portion of the house's processes found itself caught in an aesthetic loop. But when the senator-elect and her guest arrived at the door, the house paused a moment before opening, just to create anticipation. The lieutenant commander was a tall man, dark and reserved. He walked with a smooth, prosthetic gait, the motion a gliding one like a creature with more than two legs. He followed the mistress attentively through a tour of the house, noting its relationship to the surrounding mountains as if scouting a defensive position. The man was impressed, the house could tell. Laurent Zai complimented the views and the gardens, asked how they were heated. The house would have loved to explain, in excessive detail, the system of mirrors and heated water in underground channels, but the mistress had warned it not to speak. The man was Vaden, and didn't approve of talking machines. Receptive to the smells of cooking, Zai and the mistress presently sat down to eat. The house had pulled food from deep in its stores. It had slaved, or rather had commanded its many slaves, to make everything perfect. It served breasts of the small sparrow-like birds that flocked in the south forest, each no bigger than a mouthful, baked in goat's butter and thyme. Baby artichokes and carrots had gone into a stew, thickened with a dark reduction of tomatoes and cocoa grown deep underground. Meaty oranges and pears engineered to grow in freezing temperatures, which budded from the tree already filled with icy crystals, had been shaved into sorbets to divide the courses. The main dish was thin slices of salmon pulled from the snow-melt streams, chemically cooked with lemon juice and nano-machines. The table was covered with petals from the black and purple ground-cover flowers that kept the gardens warm for a few extra weeks in the fall. The house spared nothing, Even unearthing the decades-old hidden cache of its first owner's coffee, the previous senator's special blend. It served them this magic brew after they were finished eating. The house watched and waited, anxious to see what would result from all its preparations. It had so often read that well-prepared food was the key to engendering good conversation. Now would come the test. Lieutenant Commander. After lunch, Nara Oxum took him to a room with incredible views. Like the food, which had been exquisite to a fault, the vistas here almost overwhelmed Zai. Mountainscapes, clear skies, and marvelous distant waterfalls. Finally, an escape from the crowds of the capital. Best of all, however, was the large fireplace, a hearth such as a Vaden home would have. They built a small pyre of real wood together, and Nara worked with long and skillful fingers to bring it to a blaze. Zai stole glances at his hostess in the firelight. The Senator-elect's eyes were changing. With each hour at the Polar Estate, they grew less focused, like a woman steadily drinking. Laurent knew that she had stopped taking the drug that maintained her sanity in the city. She was becoming more sensitive. He could almost feel the power of her empathy as it tuned in on him. What would it reveal to her? He wondered. Zai tried not to think of what might happen between him and his hostess. He knew nothing of the ways of Vasthold. This excursion to the pole might be merely a friendly gesture toward a foreigner, a traditional offer to a decorated hero, even an attempt to compromise a political opponent. But this was Nara's home, and they were very much alone. These thoughts of intimacy came unbidden and moved creakily, almost a forgotten process. Since his captivity, Zai's broken body had been often a source of pain, sometimes one of despair and always an engineering problem, but never a locus of desire. Would Nara detect his thoughts, half-thoughts really, about possible intimacy between them? Zai knew that most synesthetic abilities were exaggerated by the gutter media. How keen were hers? Zai decided to show his curiosity, which at least would have the advantage of distracting Nara and himself from his other thoughts. So he pursued a question he'd pondered since they'd met. What was it like to be empathic as a child? When did you realize that you could read minds? Nara laughed at his terminology, as he'd expected. The realization was slow, she said. It almost never came. I was raised on the Plainhold. It's very empty there. On Vasthold, there are prefectures with less than one person per 100 square kilometers. Endless plains in the wind belt, broken only by Coriolis mountains. Constructs that channel the winds into erosion runnels, which will eventually become canyons. Everywhere on the plains, you can hear the mountains singing. The wind resonances are unpredictable. You can't engineer a mountain for a particular sound. They say even a Rick's mind couldn't do the math. Each plays its own tune, as slow and moaning as whale song, some deeper than human hearing, with notes that beat like a drum. Hiking guides can tell the songs apart, can distinguish the different sides of each mountain with their eyes closed. Our house faced Mount Ballymar, whose northern side song sweeps from thudding beats up to a soprano when the wind shifts, like a siren warning that a storm is coming. My parents thought I was an idiot at first. Zai glanced at her, wondering if the word had a softer meaning on her planet. She shook her head in response. That thought had proven easy enough for her to read. Out there on the plains, my ability went undetected. I suffered no insanity in the hinterlands. The psychic input from my large but isolated family was manageable. But I had less need of language acquisition than my siblings. To family members, I could project emotions as well as empathize. It was so effortless, my communication. My family thought I was a dullard, but a very easy one to get along with. My needs were met, and I knew what was going on around me, but I didn't see the need to chatter constantly. Zai's eyebrows raised. Strange that I became a politician then, eh? He laughed. You read my mind. I did, she admitted, and leaned forward to poke at the fire. It burned steadily now and was hot enough to have forced them to a meter's distance. I could talk, though, and contrary to what my parents thought, I was smart. I could do spoken lessons with an AI if a reward was coming. But I didn't need speech, so the secondary language skills, reading and writing, suffered. Then I took my first trip to the city. As I saw the muscles of her hand tighten on the poker, I thought the city was a mountain because I could hear it from so far away. I thought it was singing. The mines of a city are like ocean from a distance. When the wave crashes, blend into a hum, a single band of sound. Kleinberg only had a population of a few hundred thousand in those days, but I could hear from 50 clicks out the tenor of the festival we were headed to, raucous and celebratory, political. The local majority party had won the Continental Parliament. From out there on the plain, coming in by slow ground transport, the sound made me happy. I sang back at this happy, marvelous mountain. I wonder what my parents thought was happening. Just an idiot's song, I suppose. They never told you? He asked. Surprise crossed Nara's face for a moment. I haven't spoken to them since that day, she said. Zai blinked, feeling like a blunderer. Senator Oxum's biography must be well known in political circles, at least the bare facts, but Zai knew her only as the mad senator. The words chilled him, though. Abandonment of a child, loss of the family line. His vain sense of propriety rebelled at the thought. He swallowed and tried to stifle the reaction, knowing his empathic host would feel it all too well. Go ahead, Laurent, she said. Be appalled. It's okay. I don't mean to. I know. But don't try to control your thoughts around me, please. He sighed and considered the war sage's advice on negotiating with the enemy. When caught dissembling, the best correction is sudden directness. How close did you get before the city drove you mad? He asked. I'm not sure exactly. I didn't know it was madness. I thought it was the song inside me, tearing me to pieces. She turned away from him to place fresh wood on the fire. As the city grew nearer, the mind noise increased. It follows the inverse square law like gravity or broadcast radio. But the traffic going into the festival slowed us down, so the ramp up in volume wasn't exponential, as it could have been. So clinical, Nara. Because I don't really remember, not sequentially anyway. I only recall that I loved it. Riding a victory celebration of 250,000 minds, Laurent, who'd won a continental election for the first time in decades. There was so much joy there. Success after years of work, redemption for old defeats, the sense that justice would finally be done. I think I fell in love with politics that day. The day you went mad? She nodded, smiling. But by the time we reached the center of town, it was too much for me. I was raw and unprotected, 1,000 times more sensitive than I am now. The stray thoughts of passing strangers hit me like revelations. The noise of the city obliterated my own young mind. My reflex was to strike out, I suppose, to physically retaliate. I was brought into the hospital bloody, and it wasn't all my blood. I hurt one of my sisters, I think the story goes. They left me in the city. Zai gaped. There was no point in hiding his reaction. Why didn't your parents take you back home? She shrugged. They didn't know. When your child has an unexplained seizure, you don't take them into the hinterland. They had me transferred to the best facility possible, which happened to be in the largest city on Varshold. But you said you haven't seen them since. It was in Varshold's expansion phase. They had 10 children, Laurent, and their silent one, their retarded child, had become a dangerous little beast. They couldn't travel across the world to visit me. This was a colony world, Laurent. More protests rose in Zai, but he took a deep breath. No point in battering Nara's parents. It was a different culture and a long time ago. How many years were you mad, Nara? She looked into his eyes. From age 6 to 10, that's roughly age 12 to 19 in absolute years. Puberty, young adulthood. All with 8 million voices in my mind. Inhuman, he said. She turned back to the fire, half smiling. There are only a few of my kind, a lot of synesthetic empaths, but not many survivors of such ignorance. Now they understand that synesthesia implants will cause empathy in a few dozen kids a year. Most live in cities, of course, and the condition is discovered within days of the operation. When the kids blow, they ship them off to the country until they're old enough for apathy treatments. But I was desensitized the old-fashioned way. Exposure. What was it like in those years, Nara? No point in hiding his curiosity from an empath. I was the city, Laurent. Its animal consciousness, anyway. The raging id of desire and need, frustration and anger. The heart of humanity and, yes, of politics. But almost utterly without self. Mad. Zai narrowed his eyes. He'd never thought of a city that way as having a mind. It was so close to the Rick's perversion. Exactly, she said, apparently having plumbed the thought. That's why I'm anti-Rick's, for a secularist. What do you mean? Cities are beasts, Laurent. The body politic is nothing but an animal. It needs humans to lead it, personalities to shape the mass. That's why the Rick's are such single-minded butchers. They graft a voice onto a slavering beast, then worship it as a god. But something, some sort of compound mind is really there, Nara. Even on an imperial world with emergence suppressed. Even without the networks. She nodded. I heard it every day. Had it in my mind. Whether computers make it apparent or not, humans are a part of something bigger, something distinctly alive. The Ricks are right about that. Thus the Emperor protects us, Zai whispered. Yes, our counter-god, Oxum said sadly. A necessary stopgap. But why not, Nara? You said it yourself. We need human personalities. People who inspire loyalty give human shape to the mass. So why fight the Emperor so bitterly? Because no one elected him, she said, and because he's dead. Zai shook his head, the disloyal words painful. But the honored dead chose him at Quorum. 1600 years ago. They can call another quorum to remove him, if they ever wanted to. The dead are dead, Laurent. They don't live with us anymore. You've seen the distance in their eyes. They are no more like us than Rick's minds. You know it. The living city may be a beast, but at least it's human. What we are. She leaned toward him, the fire bright in her eyes. Humanity is central, Laurent, the only thing that matters. We are what puts good and evil in this universe. Not gods or dead people, not machines. Us. The honored dead are our ancestors, Nara, he whispered fiercely, as if silencing a child in church. They're a medical procedure, one with unbelievably negative social and economic consequences, nothing more. That's insane, he said. He closed his mouth on the words. Too late. She stared back at him, triumph and sadness on her face. They sat there for a while longer, the thing that had been between them broken. Laurent Zai wanted to say something, but doubted an apology would matter. He sat in silence, wondering what he should do. 3. Decompression. Swift decisions are virtuous, unless they have irrevocable consequences. Anonymous 167. Senator. The constellation of eyes glistened, reflecting the sunlight that penetrated the cultured diamond doors sliding closed behind Senator Nara Oxum. The ocular glint raised her hackles, marking as it did the eyes of a nocturnal predator. On Oxum's home planet Vasthold, there ranged human hunting bears, paracoyotes, and feral night dogs. On some deep, instinctive level, Nara Oxum knew those eyes to be warnings. The creatures were splayed, 15 or 20 of them, on an invisible bed of lovely gravity. They wafted like polychrome clouds down the wide, breezy hallways of the Emperor's inner palace, carried by the ambient movement of air. Her apathy bracelet was set to high, as always here in the crowded capital, but sufficient sensitivity remained to feel some small measure of their inhuman thoughts. They regarded her coolly as they drifted past, secure in their privilege, in their demigodhood, and in their speechless wisdom accumulated over 16 centuries of languor. Of course, their species had never, even in the millennia before imperial decree had elevated them to semi-divine status, doubted its innate superiority. They were imperious consorts, these personal familiars of his risen majesty. They were Felis Domesticus Immortalis. They were, in a word, cats. And in a few more words, cats who would never die. Senator Nara Oxum hated cats. She halted as the invisible bed passed, anxious not to disturb the air currents that informed its slow, dignified passage. The animal's head swiveled as one alien irises fixing her with languid malevolence, and she had to steel herself to return their unblinking gaze. So much for her brave anti-imperial heresies. Nara Oxum's constituency was an entire planet, but here in the Diamond Palace, the mighty senator found herself intimidated by the house pets. Her morning unease had returned the moment she had egressed across the Rubicon Pale, the protective barrier, electronic and legal, that encircled the forum and ensured the Senate's independence. The air car waiting for her at the Pale's shimmering edge had been so elegant, as delicate as a thing of paper and string. But inside the car, fragility had transformed into power, the machine's tendrils of lovely gravity reaching out to spin the city beneath her like a juggler's fingers turning bright pins, among building spires, over parks and gardens, through the mists of waterfalls. At first lazy and indirect, the sovereign air car had become suddenly urgent as it headed toward the Diamond Palace, a potter's blade incising a straight path, as if the world were clay turning on a fast wheel below. This profligate expenditure of energy to take her mere kilometers, a demonstration of the Emperor's might, awesomely expensive, exquisitely refined. Now, a few moments inside the palace, and the house cats were flying too. Oxum shivered and took a deep breath after the animals disappeared down the curving hallway, trying to remember if any of them had been black. Then she cast aside superstition and strode across the hall, braving their wafting path toward her rendezvous with the risen emperor. Another set of diamond doors opened before her, and Nara Oxum wondered what this was all about. The obvious answer was that His Majesty objected to the legislation she had proposed, her counter to the Loyalty Party's preparations for war on the Rix frontier. But the summons had been so instantaneous, only minutes after the legislation had been registered. Oxum's staff had followed her orders well, creating a subtle and labyrinthine weave of laws and tariffs, not a direct attack. How could the apparatus have recognized its purpose so quickly? Perhaps there'd been a leak, a mole somewhere on her staff or among the secular party hierarchy, and the palace had been forewarned. She dismissed this thought as paranoia. Only a trusted handful had helped write the legislation. More likely, the Emperor had been waiting, alert for any response. He had known that his loyalists' preparations for war would eventually be detected, and he'd been ready. Ready with this demonstration of alert and awesome power, an imperial summons, that extraordinary flight, this palace of diamond. That was the warning in the cat's shining eyes, she realized. A reminder not to underestimate him. Oxum realized that her contempt for the Greys, those living humans who voted for loyalty, who worshipped the dead and the Emperor as gods, had caused her to forget that the risen father himself was a very smart man. He had, after all, invented immortality. No mean feat. And over the last 1600 years had brokered that single discovery into more or less absolute power over 80 worlds. Through the doors, Oxum found herself in a garden, a vast space over which a bright sky was refracted into facets by a canopy of diamond. The path under her feet was made of broken stones, their pointed shapes driven into the earthen floor to form a precise and curving road, a mosaic formed from the remains of some ancient and shattered statue. "Look upon my works, ye mighty," she thought to herself. A short red grass grew up between the stones, outlining them with the color of dried blood. Motile vines undulated through the grass on either side of the path, a sinuous and vaguely threatening ground cover, perhaps to keep the visitor from straying. The route spiraled inward, taking Oxum past an orchard of miniature apple trees, none higher than a meter, a serpentine dune of white sand covered with a scrambling host of bright blue scorpions, flocks of hummingbirds sculpted into topiary shapes by invisible fields, and, as she reached the spiral center, a series of fountains whose misty sprays, waterfalls, and arcs of water patently did not follow the laws of gravity. Oxum knew she was close to the man himself when she came upon the calico. It lay in the middle of the path, splayed to capture the warmth of a particularly large flat stone. It was a no-breed in particular cat, whose coat was mottled with the colors of milk, apricot, and black. The spinal ridge of the Lazarus symbiont extended all the way down the tail, which moved agitatedly, though the rest of the animal's body was calm. The vertical slits of the cat's irises swelled a bit with curiosity when it saw Nara. Then the interest receded, ending in a slow, languid blink of disdain. She managed to meet its gaze steadily. A young man strode up the path from the other direction and lifted the cat to his shoulder with a practiced motion. It let out a vaguely protesting trill, then settled into the crook of his elbow, one claw reaching out across his chest, to secure itself in the black threads of imperial raiment. Her first thought was trite. He was more handsome in person. "My lord,"